Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, the son, and Bill Russell and I are all together. We're in New Hampshire. We're in a physical space. It's almost like being outdoors without the mosquitoes. And it seems so fitting to be with you in a totally natural setting, except the screens are important so I don't get eaten alive. Some of what I think people are drawn to you as you have revisited your life story, we didn't finish about the Kalahari to say that you've written about that twice mm-hmm. in times of your life. And the one that I'm the first and only actual fan mail I ever wrote to was to you, and it was after I'd known you for a decade and a half. Your book, The Old Way, tells us about who we are as a species before agriculture.
Yes.
Yes, you made very clear the first time we met all those years ago, they're fully human, just like we are.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing unmodern about them. Mm. They simply didn't bother with this agriculture thing.
That's true. It's supposedly DNA studies have shown that they are the first people, everybody descended from them, or from their ancestors. But
So that lineage is, yeah. I mean, we really are looking at ourselves.
At ourselves, yes.
As we look
at one time, yeah.
But they were fully integrated in the environment in ways that we have gotten out of the habit of which.
Oh.
What did that look like?
I sorted it out at one time, and it's in the book.
Book?
Oh, I'm sorry.
So many.
The autobiography
I'm talking about.
Yeah. A Million Years with You was the title. In terms of things, I counted how many things a Bushman woman might wear, but this is back then. Things have changed for them very drastically. So I'm talking about 1950, not 2000, or not 2000 and anything. And it might be six or seven things or up to 12 things.
Altogether?
Well, I mean, yeah, she'd have a digging stick, she'd have a front skirt and a back skirt and a cape and a string to tie the cape with and a pair of sandals maybe and an ostrich egg or two and a necklace. That comes through, and that would be it. Then I began to count the things on my desk, and 30, 50,
yeah.
Not counting all the pencils, just the jar the pencils are in. But the other things, lots of them, the Rolodex and the whatever.
You find all the contents within?
No, not even the contents within, just that. That's my desk. Then, and I also counted my sewing basket, and I think I got 40 things in my sewing basket. Mm-hmm. And it came to me that anybody's house would be like mine. I mean, I'm not a pack rat or anything, I'm just a normal house. Anybody's house would have more stuff in it than the entire 120,000 square miles of the people in Yan Yan, which is the name of where we were. And but then I thought about knowledge. Mm-hmm. And the Bushmen knew all the mammals, of course. They knew all the birds. They knew all the reptiles. And most of the insects, as far as I could tell, spiders, arachnids, and the plants. They knew the names of all plants and the properties of all plants. And if we, one of us, you know, you look out the window, you say, what is that? It's a tree. Mm-hmm. You know, never mind what kind of a tree. Mm-hmm. You see an insect, it's a bug. You don't know what kind of a bug. A mouse, it's just a mouse. You don't know what kind of a mouse. You don't know anything about it. You don't know where it makes its nest or how it, and so forth. So their knowledge in their world was like, we know our possessions. We could name probably every possession in our house. But they could name everything in the natural world. And you know, you ask people, I've asked college students, for instance, where does the sun rise? I don't know. Or one of them said over there, and he was correct, but he didn't know it was east. And you hear it's our ignorance of the natural world is, even the naturalists they don't even come close to the Bushmen.
Because they just know a specialized piece of it, or?
Oh, people do, plenty of people. I mean, scientists know absolutely specialized pieces, I'm not saying that. But It isn't part of the general knowledge, and I'm speaking of the general knowledge.
To a modern person, it sounds like they were suffering serious deprivation.
But they're modern too.
Well, a person living in what we consider a modern culture with, you know, buildings
industrialized
or even agricultural forward. One, it sounds like there's significant deprivation, which leads inevitably to the question, were they happy?
Yeah, I mean, as happy as, I would
Did
say
they
that, yes.
Did they get the right spouse and find the right work?
If they had the work. The choices were not large, and there were no choices as to what you did for work. And people were, if they weren't happily married, they'd get divorced and marry somebody else, which was perfectly okay. And
But is there a defining characteristic that you can distinguish the people who had been in this an ecological balance for 100,000 plus years compared to us? Is there any hard fast distinctions between their life experience and our life experience?
I would say that they had essentially very different life experiences. One of the things that somebody pointed out was that hunters and gatherers live in the moment. After that, not that people didn't think about the future, of course they did, but they paid attention to what was going on then. And any rustle in the grass meant something. A bird call, that would tell you something. And so they were, and with this huge knowledge of theirs, they knew what was going on, and they were listening to it and looking at it.
That's a gigantic thing you've just said. I know lots of people who are studying and practicing to be in the moment and who worry that, I mean, it's sort of almost a fad du jour of being mindful. And to be in the moment, in that eternity that is the only thing mm-hmm. we really have, we really don't have the past or the future. I'm hearing you say that that was who and what they were. They didn't have to think about it. It just was.
I think yes.
That's a radical difference.
I would say almost everything except us, people, Americans, if you will, lives in the moment. That's the way other creatures live, and it's the way hunter-gatherers live. The future becomes important. With the Neolithic, a farmer, his cow won't give milk for 9 months, and the seeds he plants in the spring don't grow until the fall, and he harvests them. The whole thing is a future-oriented way of life. And I think we, too, our industrial civilization is.
Well, I think about, and this is the mountain lion, the cougar mm-hmm. on the branch. You know, part of it would seem his or her. Shock was that he didn't know you were there. And it is part of surviving in that context, particularly when there are humans around, is knowing, being absolutely aware of the important parts, the relevant parts to you as from a survival standpoint.
Yes.
And to not be fully aware probably just scared the daylights out of them.
Or the cat's cat. It's interesting in this context that you've written an autobiography, which is not so much forward-looking, though it's you looking forward, looking back, with that kind of complexity. Do these themes of which you've written, about what you've thought, do they come up as you do your own autobiography?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, well, they're in it. I mean, I write about them. Those are the things I write about.
The fact things.
Yeah.
But is there a bigger consciousness about how these flows affect each other? How your early life, when you meet Steve, your husband, and you marry, fall in love, and you marry, and then when your children come, and as your parents age, and as you age, did you get a sense in writing the book of these big issues about where we are in time? How are we different from our Bushmen predecessors? Was there a process above just recounting, you can go back to a calendar and say, well, this happened here. But isn't there something bigger than that, writing an autobiography?
Well, interestingly, what I found when writing the autobiography was what really changed things, what really did it, what really made a difference. And it's often tiny things.
Can
that
you give an example?
From, well, I can. My grandmother, my mother's mother, they my grandmothers lived with us when we were kids, and she would tell me a bedtime story, and the story begins, it's a princess, she's imprisoned in a granary, she has to move all the grain out of the granary before sunrise or something bad will happen to her. Well, she can't, and she cries, and an ant, she has done something for an ant, and the ant sees her, and the ant goes and tells the other ants, and that's the story. And then it says, an ant came in and carried out a grain of wheat, another ant came in and carried out a grain of wheat. Another ant came in and carried out a grain of wheat, and so forth.
Which puts the little kid to
sleep. On and on, which puts the little kid to sleep, yeah. And what? But I have never forgotten that story. It guides me when I've got a difficult job. The princess didn't do the work, but the ants did, and they didn't give up. And any big job can be accomplished if you keep at it. And that was so deep in my persona. It served me very well all my life. I feel like telling everybody this story to help them.
All of us need this story, that it's those little pieces and the perseverance and the princess who it's going to get all right in the morning. That's magnificent. It's something like that that you can then look back and say, well, look where that did it.
Yes. And I put that in the book with examples of later life, big jobs of later life.
There are many big jobs. We're going to be back to talk about some more of them in just a moment. It's my big job to break away from the back.